Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Save big money and transform your home with new appliances now at Menards. We offer the lowest prices and the largest in-stock appliance selection ready to take home today. Check out top appliance brands, including KitchenAid, Maytag, Whirlpool, Amana, and Criterion. Upgrade your home and save big money on new appliances at Menards. Shop our entire selection of appliance options online today at Menards.com.
Save big money at Menards.
Today on Lightning Bugs. When most kids were just playing all the time, you were working.
Yeah. Yeah, my mom always tells a story that when I was in West Side Story when I was 10, I would be climbing a tree in our front yard, and she'd be like, Nick, you have to get out of the tree. We need to make half hour. We need to beat the rush hour traffic. So I'm sure that my parents, you know, would have wanted me to climb a few more trees, but I was very, very into performing at a very young age.
And that was your drive.
Yes, that was. And I'm lucky to say I did not have the stage parents that pushed me into the industry. If anything, they were like, honey, you don't have to do this. And I was like, no.
I'm just kind of getting a grip on someone with that much focus that young.
Yeah, I mean, well, I was doing community theater and I loved it. And I think it was floating around some idea about an agent or representation and management. I think I attached myself to that idea, not really knowing what that meant.
I can see that.
And my mom tells the story that I walked into the kitchen one day and was like, did you get me an agent yet? And she was like, what?
Hi, if you're enjoying listening to Lightning Bugs, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot. I'm just going to start off with the intro and then we can be normal after that.
Great.
If there's such a thing.
Yeah.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Lightning Bugs. Today, my guest is actor, singer, dancer, Nicholas Barish. He made his Broadway debut at 10 years old in the 2009 revival of West Side Story. Nicholas next appeared in two acclaimed Roundabout Theater Company revivals, The Mystery of Edwin Drood and She Loves Me, for his role. And you're nodding like, yeah, that's correct. Okay, good. Thanks. I'll just keep an eye on you and make sure that it's all right. For his role in She Loves Me, Nicholas received the 2016 Dorothy Loudon Award for Excellence in the Theater, as well as nominations for Drama Desk and Outer Critics Circle Awards. He's performed in many off-Broadway shows, as well as film and television. Nicholas currently stars as Orpheus in the first Broadway national tour of the hit musical Hadestown. Ladies and gentlemen, Nicholas Barish. How's it going?
Good. How are you? Thank you for that intro. It's
very good. Is it all basically right?
Yes, absolutely.
Man, so I guess I should have this in here. How old are you now?
I'm 23.
23.
Yes.
Yeah, my son and daughter are 22, turning 23 in July.
There you go. Yeah, I turned 24 in May. It's a great age. But it's also terrifying.
Well, it's funny. A friend of mine once was lamenting that his son was, he's like, my kid, this is a few years ago. He's like, my kid, he's 23 years old. And he just like works at Dairy Queen and gets stoned all the time. And then he said, I guess I was getting stoned all the time when I was 23 too. Except I invented the parametric EQ that year.
Yeah, you know, everyone's on their own journey.
That's right, and that's why we're here, because yours is unique, I think, of the guests I've had so far this year. In that, I mean, you were, when most kids were just playing all the time, you were working.
Yeah. Yeah, my mom always tells a story that when I was in West Side Story when I was 10, I would be climbing a tree in our front yard. And she'd be like, Nick, you have to get out of the tree. We need to make half hour. We need to beat the rush hour traffic. So I'm sure that my parents, you know, would have wanted me to climb a few more trees, but I was very, very into performing at a very young age.
Then that was your drive.
Yes, that was. And I'm lucky to say I did not have the stage parents that pushed me into the industry. If anything, they were like, honey, you don't have to do this. And I was like,
Is that an assumption a lot of people make since you started young, is that you've got total stage parents?
I think so. And just when you enter a job at a young, you know, 10, 11 years old, I think people just get a little uncomfortable or nervous. They're like, what is the situation? What is the motivation here? But no, they knew that I loved it. And so they were very supportive, which I'm grateful for.
10 years, that's at the end of a long 10-year journey to get there. What were you thinking before that? Like at what point, I'm just kind of getting a grip on someone with that much focus that young.
Yeah, I mean, well, I was doing community theater and I loved it. And I think it was floating around some idea about an agent or representation and management. I think I attached myself to that idea, not really knowing what that meant.
I can see that.
And my mom tells the story that I walked into the kitchen one day and was like, did you get me an agent yet? And she was like, what? So then I signed with one miraculously because through, you know, the head of our children's troupe, in Westchester, New York, they knew a professional manager and she got us in touch and I started going out on auditions and it was very just kind of, my parents were taking it one day at a time and they were like, he probably, you know, won't book anything, but we'll try it out. And then I ended up getting West Side Story a few months later and my mom broke out in hives because she realized she had to drive her kid to, 47th Street, which is an hour away, 8 shows a week for the next year or whatever. So, wow. The reality.
What did you imagine when you thought, you know, to get an agent? Did you see yourself on stage specifically, or did you imagine more television and film?
I think stage because that was all I had been doing. You know, I was just doing musicals with this children's theater troupe and community theater. So I think, you know, I've been singing and doing impressions since I was very little. So the fact that I could do that and then people were clapping for me was very enticing. The bug bit. Yeah.
Well, I remember I must have been about 10 years old, and this is way long time ago, and HBO had just started, and Neil Sedaka was on HBO, and I thought, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen, because in that era, right. You really didn't make it sound like the olden times too much, but you really didn't yet see performers. And seeing him on television, he told a story that he got his first song published when he was 13. And for me, that was it. It's like, I have to have a song published by the time I'm 13 years old. And I was 13. Once I got 13, I remembered that. And it was just really hard on myself because I didn't have anything published. I didn't know what that meant, but it kind of like you, I think as a little bit of like, oh, I need to get a manager. Like a grown-up goes, what am I going to do with the manager? And you were like, I need a manager.
I don't know to know it's possible, I guess. Although I'm trying to be better about, you know, comparing myself to others and just realizing that it is very unusual, the position I was in at 10 years old. So, you know, leave it at that.
Well, I think a lot of kids have a lot more focus younger than we think.
Yeah,
you know,
I do too.
And
absolutely.
And you getting some success at it young is unusual. But I mean, shit, if you were singing as well as you sing now or anywhere close when you were 10 years old, just your voice alone is enough reason to give you a job. I mean,
well,
you sing your ass off.
Yeah. I try.
How did that go like over the course of your teenage years then? I mean, your voice would have changed a little bit. You have to navigate a new instrument a couple of times probably.
Yeah, it's a very good question. My voice started changing around 12, 13, and I was involved in a show that I did out in LA, and it was like the pre-Broadway run of the show, and my voice was starting to change. So my range was getting limited and more limited. And also the texture and the quality was starting to
change. That's the main thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And that freaked me out for sure. Cause I knew, you know, I good enough ear that I can, I know what the difference is between my best and not my best. So that was scary. And luckily I had voice teachers who were helping me through that transition.
Cool.
And my manager, unbeknownst to me, just kept telling my mom, he's not going to work in his teen years. Kids just don't work in their teen years.
Right.
It's awkward. They're growing, they're changing, their voices aren't what they, you know. And when I did the Mystery of Edwin Drood at age 14, which was also a rare thing, but I think the awkwardness worked for me.
Right. You used it.
You know? And I mean, at the time I didn't know quite how awkward I was, but I look back and but I'm grateful that that transition happened, and it happened over a year or two, you know, and I found more of my adult voice.
Yeah. No, I can imagine that'd be tough, because I mean, but it doesn't stop. I mean, throughout your life, you wake up some years and realize it's a slightly different instrument you're working with.
Yeah. And I have a amazing voice teacher, Neil Harrelson, and he works in the musical theater world, but also the opera world. Excuse me.
I love when we start, all singers, when you start talking about your voice.
Just testing the range. Yeah. But he says that his best days are in his 50s, or, you know, and it's not till you're 30 until your full voice starts to emerge. So I have stuff to look forward to. So I'm happy about that.
Oh, I think that's probably true. No, I think that's probably true. From singers I've known. Yeah, because you relax about certain things. And if you're, well, like with anything with art, if you're willing to go with it, you know,
right.
A big one is, Tom Waits.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he ruined his voice on tour. It was probably a busted blood vessel or something. Now he could have, he was in Europe, and he'd made a record with a pretty voice. And then he had this fucking throat chisel and he was on tour, right. And he should have gone to the doctor to fix it. And then he'd have been fine. But he decided it was something to work with. He was like, I'm enjoying this.
Right. And then there's the physiological component, which is hard. I mean, I know nothing about how it works.
Really?
But yeah, something to you know, think about.
So you're not terribly analytical about it. Like, you don't talk about the retinoids and the blah, blah, blahs.
No, I don't. But my voice teacher does. And I go, oh, that's interesting. Can I sing this well right now, please? And, you know, I'm not very patient, you know. But yeah, it's fascinating. There's always more to learn. Yeah.
Do you identify as at this point, more as a singer if you had to lean, or actor?
That's a good question. I mean, I think I'm an actor because the singing almost feels like something I was born with. That there's so much to learn, you know, in terms of technique. But as an actor, I feel like there's so many nuances and the subjectivity. Like, you know, you can pretty much, anyone on the planet can hear a very good singer and a singer who's tone deaf and know the difference. But I think when it comes to acting, it's like, oh, I like that performance. I didn't care for it. And so I think there's a broader kind of spectrum of what makes a good actor, or a smart actor, or a Shakespearean actor, or a TV actor. I mean, you know, there's just,
yeah.
So I would like to identify as an actor who can sing, I guess. But
yeah. No, I think that makes sense. The singing part does seem to come supernatural, very naturally to you.
Yeah.
When you're doing when I'm thinking about the studio recording, where I might do six takes and I'm pretty damn sure that the second take was great and the third take was crap. And I have these ideas, but most of the time I hear it back, I'm proven wrong. I've realized I don't have a good ear for that.
Yeah.
You know, in your business of so much stage, do you think you kind of know when your good nights are?
I've been thinking about this lately a lot, because I think I saw an interview with Audra McDonald talking about this with her director, Lonnie Price, for Lady Day at Emerson's Bar and Grill, that play she did on Broadway. And she talks about how she would come out after a show and tell Lonnie, oh, I wasn't in it. And oh, and he was like, no, you were great. We didn't see any of what was going on in your head. So I try to remember that and think of that, because there's some shows where I'm like, oh, I feel like I'm really in the pocket.
Yeah.
And then there are times where I'm like, oh, I was ahead of it or I was behind it. And I've been talking to my cast members about this, because I have to remember that the audience really isn't going to know or care. And it's just my neurosis that's probably just getting in the way.
Or maybe they know more than we do, in a way. I mean,
right.
There may be something to that, because like I have very little experience acting, but the experiences that I have, I'm thrown into really big productions and yeah. All of a sudden all this money is being spent, and it's like I'm obviously kind of the kindergarten guy. I'm worried about things like lines. And I was working with a director recently who was like, no, just throw those lines away. Just throw those away. Just throw those away.
I love that note.
Yeah. Like, and like, you know, I don't know what the typical, you know, cliche notes are, but I did that. I just said the lines. I think that's what she meant. And yeah. I have to say, there was really something to that.
Totally.
And it seems just as soon as I got my head around that, then there wasn't something to it anymore. Then there was more to listening. And then,
yes.
Then I was listening, and then that sucked. Like, so I started thinking, okay, I'm listening, and I saw these dailies come back, and like the person I'm playing the scene with would say something, and I would just be like staring, listening. Like, it was not, no one listens that way. So I think what you do is just like, from a punter's point of view.
It's hard, but you bring up that point of, you know, as soon as I start thinking, for me, it's all over. And I did a show. We have 5 show weekends on tour, which is super challenging. And we have 6:30 shows on Sundays after a matinee. And I was so fatigued. Jeez. I told my co-star, she was very vivid in color in front of me and was almost kind of like, and I was like, am I hallucinating right now? But I realized that I was so tired, like fully wanted to close my eyes on stage, that I couldn't think.
Yeah.
And therefore I was just doing, and I was probably like, ugh, unfortunately, Nick, this is probably some of your best work, because you're just going through the motions and trusting the moment as opposed to, you know, forcing something. So
no, I think that's actually really big. And I think it's something everyone that performs, we all have to come to grips with that. It actually hurts your feelings to think that the best thing that you've done was because you were out of your own way, because you were so exhausted that you didn't have the faculties to fuck your own roll up. It's awful.
Exactly. I know that we just want control so badly, but we have to give it up sometimes. Yeah.
I'll tell you the worst. I got a concussion falling off stage before a show even started. So this was in Hiroshima in Japan. And they're like, ladies and gentlemen, Vivals, or whatever it is that they say. Because normally I wouldn't get an intro, but I remember there was an intro. And I walked into the darkness, and there's normally tape in front of the piano. There wasn't. And it was just, I stepped into a 5-foot fall onto my head, straight forward. Climbed back up on the stage. I played the rest of the show, went to the hospital, had a pretty severe concussion, managed to stay awake for the whole thing. For the rest of the tour, my band was like, you have never played this well. Like, you are, and I was just barely getting through. They're like, no, seriously, like, your playing is outstanding. Okay, so I have to be injured and brain concussed, right, in order, like, to be good.
Right. It's like, I can't tell if that's really what I want to hear right now, but thank you. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Wow.
But these things are lessons for performers. I mean, we all have to have that lesson. It's like,
yes.
And I don't even know how to analyze it. Do you? I mean, what does that mean? Your training's not worth anything, or the things that you think, or your analysis is worth nothing? Because I don't believe that's the case.
I mean, one of my teachers, Bob Krakauer, who's a renowned acting teacher, but he talks about how you do the work, and then when you show up, you have to throw it away.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of that note that you got to throw it away, but it's like, how does one throw away something when you just want to do well? And you know, I struggle with perfectionism, and, it's helpful. Lately, I found it's helpful to just look at the other actor, look at, you know, and try to listen without over listening or, you know, pushing myself, and to just be there and trust it. But it's very challenging. Yeah.
Oh, I think everyone who has ever watched, you know, even just television should take, like, you know, maybe a semester's worth of taking a role in acting. It would be very interesting to most people who've never done it before. It's such a trip. Now, this is a podcast about creativity, and I have been trying to sort of, you know, establish in a way what even creativity is. How much of that do you think is in acting? What's your take on creativity in acting and performance?
I mean, going into, my reference point right now is this role because I'm very in it. Yeah. But when I went into Hadestown, it was new for me because it was already an established show on Broadway. Right. Hit Broadway show. I was walking into a role that someone else originated. And so the rehearsal process was kind of a push and pull between, okay, I need to serve this piece and as it is on Broadway right now. And that is more, I don't know how much of my creative brain was used there, but luckily I had a director who did not give me notes on this song or that song. And so I was able to go home and think, okay, I have some leeway here to create and to put my own spin on it. So in the rehearsal process for a show like this, that's where the creativity happened. And I was lucky because, you know, you could have a director who could say, do this, say it this way and say it that way. And then you're in your head and you're like, am I being creative?
The first guy did it this way.
Right. So I think, with theater, it's great because every night you have a chance to do it again and discover new things. I think it's very different for TV and film. And I haven't done enough of it yet to know how to use all my creativity on set and how to use it, you know, to the best of my ability. Because, you know, I just have to get used to the lingo. And
you know, in my limited experience, like especially sitting around the table read portion, you know, there's always two or three actors on these things who try to improvise.
Yep.
I wish they wouldn't.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Improvising is definitely creative, but it can also screw things up. And that's, it's a whole other conversation, but it's a balance, but I find it so fun to be on stage every night live because I think I can't help but be creative. You know, I'm put in a position where I have to be. I have to tell this story for this new crop of people. Mm-hmm. So I know the creative juices are flowing. Finding how exactly to be fulfilled creatively in a job, especially as demanding as this one is. I have to remember, no, Nick, like this is a play. It's entertainment and it's creative and it's fun and you don't have to be so serious about it, you know?
Right. So. Yeah. I mean, I think that, I'm starting to think that almost any, occupation or endeavor can be extremely creative, whether it's, you know, architecture or being a barber or landscaper or, you know, hopefully you're not too terribly creative if you're an accountant, you know, you get in trouble for that. But most things you can be. And then there are all of the things that we do in the arts and the assumption is that they're creative. And, you know, my gig, you know, some of it's very creative and make a song. Other times I feel like I'll wind up, I'm just doing what I'm told, even if I'm the one that told me to do it. If yesteryear me told me to do it and I do it over and over again. Are there things in your life that are significantly creative that aren't professional? And it's even making an omelet, you know?
Totally. I mean, cooking is not my strong suit, but over the pandemic, I didn't have a lot of acting or singing to do. So I did The Artist's Way, which I'm sure you're familiar with, the Julia Cameron book. And that really changed things for me because I'm in a family of writers. I've always wanted to write, but didn't really feel like that was my place or avenue to try it. And she gave me the confidence to, she meaning Julia in her pages, to start writing and putting things down on paper. And that, as an actor, you know, there's not a lot of control. And I think, especially just in the industry, and right. It was the first time I realized, oh, I can put something on paper that's only from my head, and whether it's good or bad, you know, it doesn't matter, but at least it's mine, you know, and I can.
Do you follow the morning pages ritual?
I sure do. I try to do it every day. And it's funny because I find myself trying to write sometimes as opposed to just what she wants you to vomit everything. Which always ends up being more helpful when I'm like, I hate this, I hate that, I hate this person, you know, because then you realize how insane your own thoughts are and you're like, Nick, we gotta calm down. Like this is, you know, but it definitely clears my head and I've benefited a lot from that.
You have, aspirations then, since you were, you know, you're achieving goals that you sort of set for yourself when you were 9 and a half. So, do you have, is writing or is there something else on the horizon that, that you want to go for?
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I do want to do more TV and film to just change it up and also to learn more. But yeah, writing is definitely the next thing I'd like to put my attention towards. And, you know, being on the road, like, as you know, there isn't a whole lot of time for other things.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, in this job in particular. But yeah, I'd like to write more, write for the stage. I wrote a little one-act play, and I'm in a family full of editors, and I sent it through the family editors, and they had positive thoughts, which is amazing because we're very critical of each other. So
this is interesting. So if you're used to seeing the process of writing and part of it being editing, while you're writing, do you feel you're over editing yourself naturally, or where do you sit, more on morning pages spew or closer to because I'm a self editor and I have to work at that. I have to make sure that I stop it. Stop writing the critique of this. Write the fucking piece.
Yeah. I was writing at night, probably again, because I was exhausted and couldn't overthink it. And I know a lot of that's, you know, a common time to be creative at night. But so yeah, that probably helped me get out of my head. And yeah, I think when it's goofy and silly, and when it's, again, for me, it's about, you know, steering away from the seriousness of it all. And so when I'm having fun putting something on paper or even on the stage, it tends to be the thing that's rewarded most. Yeah.
Well, let's get the question and then we can both take a stab at answering it with our infinite wisdom.
Hi, I was just wondering how you treat different forms of acting, like on-screen acting versus voice acting, and how you think venue changes in acting performance.
I'm going to let you have that one because I don't act much.
Yeah, I mean, I am, in terms of voice acting, I haven't done a ton of voiceover work, but I'll speak to the venue question because that's really fascinating and something I did not discover until I was on tour. I mean, even just the acoustics of a house. Last week we were in East Lansing, Michigan, and our engineer, our sound team said that this house is very, what do they call it?
Live.
Yes, that's it. Right. So, and I went, oh, okay. I don't really know what that means. But then when you get on stage and you hear this, a lot of, you know, reverb, I don't know the technical terms. But,
that's it.
And so then I'm hearing my own voice and I'm maybe not wanting to edit it, but lean into the fact that I have more freedom. if a note is like a teensy bit flat, or I want to use vibrato a little more here, it's going to, you know, resonate a little differently in this house. So vocally it's been interesting to calibrate, in the moment. And then, you know, in terms of just audiences, another thing I love about theater is you never know how they're going to react to a certain moment. A laugh that always happens may not happen. You might think I am all of a sudden not funny.
Yeah.
Or at the end, you know, not to spoil it, and from my show, it's not a happy ending. And there was someone really going through it in the front row, sobbing, And of course that's going to affect me on stage because it's loud and it's in my ear. So that's what keeps it exciting too on a daily basis is just seeing how people react. And in this COVID world, we don't have a lot of interaction with audience members. So that's how I kind of gauge their responses on stage. I don't know if that fully answered your question.
No, I thought that was a great answer, especially interested in the acoustics mm-hmm. part, something people don't think about. But part of your live environment is liveliness of your room. I mean,
yeah.
Sometimes I'm sure, and I guess it's probably the right thing to do to slow down. This is my experience, is slowing down, articulating more, leaving space between words, because it's, you know, one syllable is still going when the next one starts, right? Because you're in the biggest men's room ever designed, and right. And you want people to understand you're communicating. But now totally. when you hear a recording of that back, if the room is not in the recording and it's a close sounding recording, it can sound utterly insane. Which is like, who is my audience? The recording or the audience? Because sometimes you're recording live and all the things that you think, okay, well, the audience and I are both on Mars tonight. There's something in the air. This is fucking crazy. It feels like everything should go fast. You know, and then you hear it come back and you're like, what drugs was I on?
Yeah, it's so true. And it's so tiny, these nuances, but
yeah. You think you have the audience's number usually now within the first two or three, you know, reaction spots? Like if they like this, they're that kind of audience and they're going to like that.
It's tough. It's really tough. We're in houses where they're far back and there's also a COVID divide.
Yeah.
So they're even farther back than they normally are. So sometimes it's really hard. And actually one of our associate directors had to tell us the other day, guys, trust me, they're with you. I know that you can't hear them and feel them. But there's a couple, I would say, laugh lines for me that, you know, once I get them, I'm like, phew.
Hurdles. Yeah. Laugh hurdles.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably, I suppose that's the worst, really, you know, throwing a joke grenade that doesn't go off.
Yeah, that's not the best feeling.
That's pretty rough. Because it's not really like you had, you know, someone sobbing in the front row, but you don't need that reaction.
Right.
You know, you can know that they're moved and they don't have to be going for their hanky.
But, exactly.
But when you say some stupid shit and it's like last night, they're like, tonight's like,
yeah. And especially, I mean, in our show, it's not a comedy. So I think we squeeze out the laughs that we can get. And if they don't happen, we're like, well, you know, you all are really in for it because, you know, things take a turn.
Yeah. Have you thought about making an album, writing songs, just doing something that was completely musical?
Yes, I have thought about writing songs. I'm not sure yet whether I have the talent or the discipline to do that. My mom's a songwriter, and she's so good at it. And I don't know. I'd like to try it. In terms of an album, people have suggested that might be something I would want to do. But I don't know yet whether it would be original music or covers or classical or musical theater or pop, or there's so many questions in the air that I think I'm just not.
I mean, I think the best answer to that usually for me is, what's the album that you want to hear? Like,
right.
But, and not the one that you want to hear, you do, but it's, I mean, that sometimes, you know, as a music listener, music fan, I'll put on parts of albums and parts of stuff and realize that's not really it. That's not really what I'm wanting to hear. That's not really what I'm wanting to hear. I want to hear a little bit of that. And then you're like, the only way that I'm going to get to sit down on the sofa and listen to a front to back thing that I really want to hear is I'm going to have to make that. So like, boy, if I were the king, I'd make that record right there.
Right.
And I think that's the best way to do it. Like if you just sitting on the sofa and you're like, what do I want to hear? Not your ego's not attached to it or anything. Just what do you want to hear? Then just make it. Like, make it tired so you don't think about it. Like, we're...
That's great. That's great advice. Yeah. I love that.
I mean, do you want to hear an album that has songs that you already know? Because as a singer, you'd be like, oh, I can imagine doing that. But when you hear those songs, is that what... I don't know. Like, what? How do you hear... First thing that comes to your mind, if I said, just what's the album you want to hear?
It's probably at this point a Stephen Sondheim, because I love him and he just passed, and that's what I've been listening on repeat. But I think I also just get overwhelmed because there's so much great music out there. That's true. My ego definitely is like, well, what can you do? What can you contribute? But of course we can all contribute more. And there's only 88 keys. So
yeah,
there's only so much you can do.
Yeah. I mean, really there's 11 notes, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that has always been like, you're at the age now where you're being thoughtful, you know, like when we jump into our first discipline, we didn't stop to ask, do we need another actor? Do you need another musician? You're like, let me add.
Right.
I'm doing this. Then later, if you begin to cross genres and disciplines, then that's the question, you know?
Right.
I think that's a very thoughtful thing to think about. Like that's very nice. It's like, we've got so much music, like, I don't want to impose on you, but I think, you know, I think impose. Do it. Why do we need an extra one? I don't know. Because someone wants to hear what you have to say.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter how many people.
Thinking about that word audacity too, which Julia Cameron talks about in Artist Way as well, where it's like talent is talent, but unless you do something with it, it just sits there, you know?
Yeah.
So.
It does. Yeah. And the reason I'm even doing this podcast is because of the number of people I talked to who were, you know, full grown ass adults who had a passion for something and felt they were not, it wasn't appropriate. It's like, no, that's not what I do. Like, and I had done that myself. Like, I was spending a good deal of my 30s and 40s photographing. And everyone's like, oh, make a book of photographs. I'm like, why would I litter the world with that when there are great photographers out there who are doing it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And now I look back on that, think, you know, that's its own kind of ego issue there. That's like, don't question it. You don't know. Just do it. So I hope you make a record, because you sing your ass off. And I just think, you know, so many of us are making records for all different kinds of reasons, and it'd just be neat to hear one with your voice on it.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And yeah, it's on the some sort of bucket list. So
it's on the list.
Now I have to make it a reality.
Yeah. Well, and you're working.
And I'm working.
Yes. And traveling.
And traveling, which I'm very grateful for. But yes, time is also a factor.
Yeah, well, that's right, because you're not in any different position than if I talked to, you know, I don't know, I said an architect to begin with.
Yeah.
Who said, I'm working all the time, I don't have time to make an album. That's what you're doing. You know, like,
it's
you're
so
trying
funny,
to find a Denny's that you won't get food poisoning at in the Midwest somewhere at 2:00 in the morning after you roll up on the bus. I mean...
Ben, when I tell you that is... painfully accurate. I don't even know how you came. I mean, that is wow. I just had an experience hearing that.
Oh shit.
He knows. Yeah.
And to be clear, before we have to edit this thing for you know, corporate product placement reasons or not placement, I don't think that any one place has the corner on bad food, by the way. So I had a lot of great moons over my hammy. It's all good.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
But you are like, you know, that's an obstacle course for you to, you're getting rewarded for doing something that's sort of creative. Right now, you're probably repeating yourself a lot, right? So you're getting rewarded for that.
Totally.
It's not any easier for you to jump into a singing career than it would be for my mother. In fact, it'd be easier for my mother. She's retired.
Yeah, in a way, yes. And it's funny, to speak to the time component, I was watching an interview with Helena Bonham Carter she was doing The Crown, and she was like, actors are so pathetic because, you know, you just want a job, you're not working, and then you get the job and you're like, when are my days off? It's just like pathetic, you know. Oh, but I did go from one extreme to the other in this particular case, where I was sitting at home doing nothing and now, you know, working a lot. Finding the balance.
Perspective, yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Helena's perspective. We love it.
Normally, you know, actors are, I think of actors as being probably more, God, how do I say it? Look, musicians are a lot more self-obsessed and self-centered than, say, you know, a barber would be or something, you know.
Sure.
But actors are up there. Like you guys are absolutely really thinking about yourself. But what's amazing to me about actors is that three quarters, if not more, of every actor's job is getting roles and rejection.
Yes.
Rejection, 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 rejection.
Yes.
That's some kind of joke from God that's your lot that mm-hmm. you have to put up with. I don't think your average person understands how much rejection a successful actor deals with. Where do you put that?
Yeah, I mean, that's when I look back and I look at my 9, 10, 11-year-old self and I think, you know what? I'm glad that little kid was exposed that early to rejection and had parents who was like, who were, you know, said, it's actually not you, you know? And the rejection is hard. Yeah. And especially when you go these long stretches without working. And then in this particular case, I'm, you know, one of the leads of this musical, and it's very, people, you know, they love the show and you're getting so much great feedback all of a sudden in your life. And you think, well, when I, you know, didn't get those string of 20 jobs before, was that still the case? So it's one extreme to the other. But yeah, the rejection's hard. And I try to look at it as, you know, you just have to do your best with whatever audition you're going out on. And one of my teachers says, book the room, not the job. You know, if you can kind of sprinkle your good work wherever you go, eventually the seeds that you plant will blossom, you know, years later. Yeah. And I'm starting to now realize that, having been in the business for, I guess, over a decade now, it's planting seeds, and it is about relationships more than it's about booking that one job that you really wanted. So try to keep that.
Do you do much like the equivalent of a musician jamming? Like, I know when I lived in LA, I knew actors that did improv and all kinds of just local stuff that didn't pay just because they kept them busy and they did it. And then there was another kind just did not do that. Just all auditions and gigs, and that's it. Do you jam?
Yeah, I mean, I try to do readings of friends' works and new works, and I have a practice group that I'm very grateful for, where we just run scenes and we give each other notes. And sometimes
You were actually working on, like that you're in. Okay.
Or, you know, someone will say, hey, I auditioned for this 2 weeks ago. Can we run it? I feel like I didn't hit this moment, or can I get feedback? And it's all working actors, and we give each other feedback, which is very helpful. Sometimes
that's
hurts,
awesome.
But that's, yeah, you know, what it is. Our phrase is hit me. and it really does feel like that. but that's great. And that keeps the wheels greased and the creativity flowing when you're
not
just
smart.
Yeah.
I think that's smart. Is there, you know, if in my gig, which is, I'm a songwriter first. That's the way I think of myself.
Right.
You know, it's the dreaded malady is, you know, writer's block, right? Mm-hmm. In yours, I guess it's stage fright.
Yeah.
Have you had moments where you just went out and froze? What's your experience and your understanding of that? I think I'm someone who's seen it on TV. Like, you know, so mm-hmm. to me, it's like some Laurence Olivier story where all of a sudden after, you know, 50 years on a stage, like just freezes up. Have you seen that or do that?
Yeah. I think when I, again, back to just the overthinking, when I start to think about the fact that thousands of people have their eyes on me mm-hmm. and are watching my every move and are expecting greatness. As soon as I start to go down that path on stage, I get really nervous. It's the moments when I'm, again, just more grounded and telling the story and remembering that I'm just a human being performing for other human beings where it's more doable. So I think when I start to think about the gravity of, you know, the size of the theater or the show or the, you know, the role, I get pretty nervous. But before each show, I don't get too nervous anymore, which is good for me.
You're prepared.
Yeah, I think so. I try to do some, you know, pre-show rituals and remind myself of a few things and why I'm doing it and that it's a whole new audience and they don't know what to expect and they're not judging me as hard as I think that they are.
So. Yeah. The mind is a terrible thing.
It is.
So since you were, you know, you've done the Artist Way book, which I've never read myself. It seems like everyone I know has. And so by proxy, I know something about it, but mm-hmm. I hit up all my guests to give us an exercise to do for a week. Yeah. Did they prepare you about that?
They did tell me.
Great.
I might steal from Julia. I don't know if that's allowed.
No, that's fine. I think look, you're our teacher for the week. So the thing is you're the boss of us. And just tell us our new week's resolution.
Yeah, I would say get up. It's very hard to do this, but longhand stream of consciousness as soon as you get up. I do 3 pages. That's what Julia recommends. But you can start with a page. It's going to hurt a little bit. And just do it. And there's no expectation. You could literally, I mean, sometimes I write, you know, I have to pee. My nightmare was crazy. I hate this. I'm tired. And to just do that, I think, separates you from your mind in a way. And you can have some distance and think, oh, wow, you know, it's not that bad. It really isn't. So,
is there anything you'd want to narrow it down to? Like you said, she keeps it at 3 pages. Do you want to amend any of it or make it anything at all about it that we can be specific? Like everyone's going to get up in the morning and do this before coffee or anything?
Before anything, as soon as you get up, roll out, sit down, start. I would say aim for 3 pages. If you can't get to 3 pages, that's okay.
Is it important that it's written? And not on a computer?
It has to be written and you can't pick up your pen. So even if it's gibberish, even if it's blah, 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 blah. Sometimes I repeat the same phrase and I say, what's next? What now? What now? What now? Right. I don't know. And
interesting. Okay. Yeah. So at the end of the 3 pages, put it up. You just put it up and move on. Drop the
move
mic.
On.
You're done.
Do you ever read it again? No.
You
never read it.
You don't mine it for ideas. This is just fecal matter
can.
Of your brain.
But for me, I'm scared what I'll find because I don't want to go back there. But it's just a good palate cleanser, and I think the rest of your day you're a little more mindful. Yeah.
Great. All right. Well, look, it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you very much for
thank you so much, Ben. This has been great.
Your time with us. Thank you.
Of course.
Hi, if you're enjoying listening to Lightning Bugs, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps a lot.